We're continuing this morning in our series on values. And I've been given, well, actually I asked. I was offered some options, and I chose the one about being real and authentic, which is why I had to cough right at the beginning, so I don't pretend anything. I want to start off with a question. Can someone tell me about that?
What you see is what you get.
Sorry, Tanya?
What you see.
You're not normally this quiet, Tanya.
What you see is what you get.
WYSIWYG. Who's heard of WYSIWYG before? Hands up in the air. Come on, boldly. Ah, I was hoping there'd be a clear message there, that they'd be mainly people of my generation and Al's generation. But there's a lot of younger people in there as well.
Much.
Okay. Yeah, okay. We'll argue about that later, shall we? WYSIWYG is something that was introduced into the world of IT, and particularly PCs, round about 35 years ago, in the early 1980s. That's right, isn't it, Sheila? Yeah, you remember the 1980s. And WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get. There's a clue in the words there. What it was... If you go back to the days of the original IBM desktop PC, you know, this pale grey box that sat on another pale grey box with a pale grey keyboard in it, everything that appeared on the screen was in different shades of green. You had a dark green background and the lettering was light green. I think that's the way it was, wasn't it? Was it, Howard? And you'd type up something there and it would appear on the screen, and then you'd go through something really complicated, and it would send a signal off to a printer that was connected to it via a really thick cable, yeah? And then this Wi-Fi nonsense. And something would come out of the printer. And what would appear on the printer wouldn't really bear that closer resemblance to what was actually on the screen. In other words, visually, what comes out of the printer accurately, yeah, represented what was on the screen, but it didn't look like it. So the lettering was different, the spacing was different, the paragraphing would end, sentences would end it would flow over the page in different page widths to what you actually saw on the screen. And WYSIWYG was a great step forward, because what it did was it introduced an extra bit of software that enabled you to get far closer a representation on paper to what actually you saw on the screen in front of you. It took years for that to get really effective. And initially, it was a tolerable approximation, but as computers got more powerful, they were able to handle more complicated messages, and so you'd get a far better representation. So now, if you sit there with your laptop and you press the button, and it comes out on screen, you just don't think about whether or not it's the same thing. Go back 30, 35 years, you'd have question to wonder whether it was actually the same thing. So you go back 30, 35 years ago in terms of technology, what was happening in essence was that there was a very, very crude approximation happening. Nowadays, it's as close to identical as you can imagine. Okay, that's the general drift that's happened in technology, and yet somehow, if we think about society, it's almost as though in many respects we've gone in the opposite direction. So things used to be straightforward and you just took them at face value 35 years ago in the main. Not universally the case, of course, but in the main, you know, what you saw was what you got 35 years ago. Nowadays, I'm just wondering if there's something else going on in the world. There's a few examples. Emails. I had an email a few days ago. You can't read it from there. Let me give you some highlights. You might be able to see the top red line, "Thank you for travelling with us." I didn't. "Dear Geraint Miles," I wouldn't have typed my name this way, but all lowercase, no space, no capitals, nothing like that. "Thank you for checking us out last week." I didn't. "In recognition, we would like to offer you a token of appreciation." No, you wouldn't. You may make your selection before January the 30th, 2019. No, I can't, because you emailed me on the 15th of February. Click on the button below and enter the gift code, something, and the customer ID. Click select gift. No way. We understand that you have a choice in air travel, and thank you for flying with TUI. I haven't, and I don't intend. Here's the killer, though. Sincerely. Brandon H., Managing Director, TUI. There isn't a Brandon H. who's a Managing Director anywhere in TUI, according to their website. unsubscribe from future emails. Bit Magenta Inc., PO Box 1, Ibrahim Patnam, Krishna DT, AP 521456, which is actually a post box somewhere in India. I don't think that's what it appears to be, is it? What about this? More fine print than ever. Anyone changed their insurance policy recently? Has anyone here read the 23 pages of fine print that comes with an insurance policy? Stu? God. Look, even Stu can only answer occasionally to that one. What else there? That's my favourite, supermarket adverts. There's one going out now, which is a very quick advert. I think it's Aldi, a basket of stuff from Aldi. It's about 20% cheaper than a basket of stuff from Tesco. There's fine print in the corner. The advert isn't there long enough to read the fine print, which qualifies massively the big 20% cost saving that they claim in that advert. It's not to say that Aldi aren't good. Good one there. A few years ago, appeared in the press, Lidl recalls peanuts because labels fail to warn that the packets may contain nuts. It said it in German, but not in English. Are things really what they seem to be? I think this travels a little bit more what he's bound to appear, isn't he? Be honest. President Trump, fake news is the enemy of the people. That, to me, is the ultimate proof that Americans don't do irony. It's true. I'll say no more. But it can get a little bit more sinister than that. Are things really what they seem to be? President Maduro in Venezuela, and this is tragic, this is. His government announced a few days ago that there is no hunger in Venezuela. You can see a poster there of an inset poster of a lady carrying a poster. The poster translates as, "Mr. President, Venezuela is hungry for food, not bullets or repression." So we need to ask ourselves this question. What you see is what you get. Are things really what they appear to be? We're looking at real and authentic today. We will if this thing will communicate. There we are. The guys have put up a detailed explanation for us on the subject of real authentic. You're not going to be able to read it. Don't worry about that. You'll be able to see this properly at some stage. I just want to talk us through the big side of this at this stage. For those of you who are nerds, there are 187 words in it. There are 11 bullet points. Let's read out some of the words. Very beginning, we say there, Woody is a place where you are free to be the person you are, which we then have to translate. It doesn't mean that if you're an axe murderer, you're free to be an axe murderer in this place. But if you're a vulnerable, shy person, you are allowed to be vulnerable and shy. You don't have to pretend to be someone else. You are welcomed and encouraged to be welcoming. And then the middle column, corporate. If you want to see how this works out, how we demonstrate that this really is a value in the life of the church, those are the things that you could expect to see when we meet together, and these are the things that we choose to try to arrange as a church. So that's the corporate side of things. Then, what does this mean to us at an individual level? Well, for example, it means that being real and authentic means that we have to be non-judgmental and we have to develop a welcoming heart. And it goes on like that. So there's lots of good stuff like that in there. But I want to suggest that we need a bit of a health warning on stuff like this as well. It might be unique to me, but 11 bullet points in my mind invite, say, do I tick these off? It's very easy for someone like me to do that. And anybody else react to lists in that way? Lists are there, yeah. 1, 2, well done. It's men. No, I'm sure that's not true either. Tanya likes ticking lists as well. That's good. That's 5 of us. And it's easy for us to get drawn into something that actually is a distraction from the really main thing. See, there's a root and fruit argument going on here. The fruit is what you see. The fruit is not the root. So in this case, actually doing things is not the origin and is not the foundation of who we are as a church. Being is the foundation of who we are as a church. So I'm not going to actually attend to any of those detailed bullet point items this morning. You'll have a chance to look at that separately. Ignore that one. I'm just going to skip over that one. Right in the middle of the statement about our value itself is this statement. And this goes really to the heart of who we are. I think this is an absolutely brilliant statement. What does being real and authentic mean in terms of Woody? This is who we are. This is who we strive to be. This is what we're pressing into. We seek restoration. We seek healing and we seek growth, becoming the people that God has made us to be, walking towards Jesus and being changed by him. So our value, which is being real and authentic, is grounded, it's rooted in that statement, and fundamentally, it's that last line, walking towards Jesus and being changed by him. Anything that we do, that we pursue, if it is to meet a real life-giving sense of being real and authentic, is rooted in that. And so when we come to our 11 bullet points, they're a great illustration of when we're real and authentic followers of Jesus, when we're walking towards him, when we're facing him, when we're being changed by him, will issue in things like these 11 bullet points. We will be people who are warm and open and welcoming, who accept people without putting them into boxes, without judging them, without qualifying them, nonetheless wanting them to be part of a community that is fully facing Jesus, that is walking towards him and comprises individuals and a community of people that are actually being changed by him. Over the course of this last 2 months, and I've had this subject real and authentic in my mind, pretty much all the readings that I've gone through over the last 2 months have had something significant to say in terms of the importance of being real and authentic. First one there. Luke 12, the Mary who anointed Jesus with a precious perfume, the way that she worshipped him, Judas Iscariot was present. He said, that money could have been given to the poor. That's what she did. But then a little while later, the Judas who used a kiss to betray Jesus. What does that tell us about the importance of being real and authentic? The second one then, Joseph, a Levite, plus Ananias and Sapphira. Anybody know who Joseph, a Levite, is? Also known as Barnabas. He's introduced to us in Acts 4. Barnabas, or Joseph, a Levite, was from out of town. He owned a piece of land. He sold it, put the entire proceeds at the... he gave the entire proceeds to the apostles and said, meet the needs of this community using this. That is a huge thing to do. That could well have been ancestral land that he was giving up. That's a massive step to take. He simply handed the proceeds over. Immediately after that account, then Luke records for us the story of Ananias and Sapphira, who pretended to do the same. They had a piece of land, and they sold it, and they bought part of the proceeds, but they evidently said, this is everything, we're putting in everything, just like him. We want to be with him, but they weren't real and authentic, and it cost the two of them their lives in that instance. The final one there then is Jesus and the religious leaders. Matthew 23 is the most scathing criticism of what happens when religion rules the roost. And in that instance, men decide, oh, we know what needs to be done. We can sort things out. Matthew 23 and verse 15 is basically Jesus says, you will go to the ends of the earth to make a convert. And then because you're the kind of people they are, you make them twice the sons of hell that you are yourself. Being real and authentic is a big thing, and it really matters. So I want us to look briefly at one passage, John chapter 17. This is one of the most significant bits in Scripture. In the period from John chapter 13 through John chapter 17, that's five chapters, John records what happened in the upper room. It's an amazing tale. It starts off with Jesus saying, look, you are to understand leadership is servanthood. If that means getting down and washing one another's feet, you do it. He takes them through. This is the Father's promise to you. I and he will come and make our home with us. He says things like, if you love me, you will obey my commands. He talks about the vine. He said that Israel is not really the true prototype. It's a pale image, he said, of God's promised people. I am the true vine. And if you're part of me, you will produce fruit and I will prune you. And if someone is so disconnected from me that you produce no fruit, I will cut you off. And right at the end of this passage, there's a whole chapter devoted to Jesus praying. There are other examples in the New Testament of Jesus praying, but they're all quite short, or he talks to them about how to pray. Pray like this, he says earlier on. But this is an intensely significant moment where Jesus prays for the disciples and also for all of us here this morning. He prays for them. He starts off by praying, Father, I'm going to press on to what you've called me to do. I'm going to set myself apart for what is going to happen in the next few hours. Okay, it was the arrest. It was being mocked. It was being judged. He was being condemned to death. All of that, Jesus said, I'm setting myself apart for that. He then prays for the disciples. That's the group, by then, the group of 11. Because Judas had already gone out into the night at that point. Praying for them. They are mine. They belong to me. I haven't lost one of them. And he prays for them. Then he adds these five verses that we've got. He adds seven verses at the end where he prays and he draws you and me into this. And here's the five verses I want us to reflect on this morning. This is how Jesus prays for them. They are there. They hear it. Why? Because they're meant to hear it. This is Jesus addressing his father with the most urgent, important thing that he has to ask his father for his disciples and for you and for me. And this is what he says. My prayer is not for the disciples alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. And that's you and me. That all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them, even as you have loved me. I'm going to read that again. Close your eyes this time. Jesus was praying these words for you, okay? So we need to take them with utmost seriousness. It is a huge statement. My prayer is not for the disciples alone. I pray also for you who are gathered in Woody this morning, who believe in me through the message of the disciples, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them, even as you have loved me. I'm just going to pick out three short phrases from that. Come on. This shouldn't be directional, should it, particularly? No, it shouldn't. So Justin's head is between me. No, that can't be anything to do. Okay. May they be one. And remember, this is all in the heading of being real and authentic. It takes us back to that central statement in our values. We are to become the people God has made us to be, walking towards Jesus and being changed by him. May they be one, just as you are in me and I am in you. Doesn't mean, the Greek word one just means one. It's not particularly more complicated than that. But it really does mean one. It doesn't mean splinter groups. It doesn't mean, oh, I have my chosen place and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To us, we could understand it in common language, something like a real oneness of heart. This is real family and this is deep. It's a deep attachment. It's a deep belonging to one another. It's a deep loving of one another. It is having at the heart of who we are the person of Jesus. People like Rob, like my brain is gone. I can't remember his surname now. Rob Parsons. It's Rinog Vaur, that one. What's his name? Rob Knowles. Would use a phrase like relational unity, okay? This is deep, okay? And I'll be honest, I can't explain this. I cannot adequately do justice to this. But this is Jesus praying for us this morning. Second one. Can you put it on the screen? Yeah, put it on... yeah, put it on... put it through Easy Worship and let's forget about this. We need to find a solution to this. This is madness. It'll be back there in just a few seconds. Don't worry about that. But yeah, try and keep the really big stuff in this in mind. Okay? This is Jesus praying that they might be one. And he draws the parallel. He doesn't say, because, you know, here's an example of people who are committed together. What he says is draw the highest... That's great, thanks. He draws the highest example. He can say, as I am in you and you are me, he's talking about the unity of the Godhead. And it's not only just, you know, that there is a oneness, but there is a depth to it. There is an otherness about it that Jesus is saying, Father, I want them to be like that. The second point there then is this, may they be in us. That appears throughout John 14, there's a reference to Jesus being the true vine. Remain in me and I will remain in you. What is our first attachment? The world will think we're bonkers by this, by the way. But the world does not know God. Doesn't matter how clever people are. Doesn't matter how fine their arguments are. Doesn't matter how great their works of service are. Unless, if they don't know Jesus, they do not know God. That's what Scripture says. You've got a pale imitation. You've got enough to point you in the right direction. There is only one real thing, and that is the God who is fully and perfectly revealed in the person of Jesus. And Jesus says, may they be in us. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Those 11 bullet points will come out. Yeah? When you and I are found in him and we remain in him. And Jesus says, apart from him, we can do nothing. Oh yeah, we can do that. We can tick off the 11 points. But we will not carry the savour of Jesus if all we do is tick off the 11 points. When we carry the savour of Jesus, those 11 points will be ticked off for us. That's very, very different. And then on the next slide then, Jesus says this, I have given them the glory you gave me. This is big. To know what your understanding of the word glory is, very often with it, I think instinctively in terms of what happened in Isaiah 6, where Isaiah quotes, saw the Lord in his splendor, and all he could do was fall down in abasement before what he saw. Glory properly is what happens when God's character and person are revealed. Glory is all to do with the excellence of who God is. It's to do with his purity, his character, his nature, everything that makes him what he is. And so if you think of glory in terms of halos or bright lights or stuff, that's the consequence of glory. When the manifestation of God's character or person happens, the outcome is glory. And Jesus says, I've given you glory. I've shown you who the Father truly is. You have experienced glory if you've fully encountered Jesus. On the next slide. So Jesus prays for people in three very major ways. He prays that you and I would firstly be one, that you and I would be in them, and that you and I would bear his glory, that we would, with increasing measure of faithfulness and authenticity and reality, show the world who Jesus really is. That's a hard one. My brain is a bit cooked at this stage, so let's look at some people, shall we? I've got here examples of four people. First one, Michael Green. Anybody heard of Michael Green? Good photo of him there. Michael Green is renowned for being, having a deep, deep well of joy within him. You know, he doesn't know how not to smile. He didn't know how not to be full of life and full of joy. Michael Green was a scholar. He was a bit of a brain on him. He had three first-class honours degree from Oxbridge. Bit of a mind on him. He was an evangelist. He was a church leader. He was very influential. He's quite an amazing bloke. I'm pretty sure, I think I'm right in saying, he's half Welsh as well. His parents were Welsh. Or rather, his father's family was Welsh. And he died about a week and a half ago. You know, those who knew him are full of, wow, it's amazing to know someone like that. Someone who you could say is real and authentic. 3 years ago, he had a heart attack. He was taken to, I think it was the Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, and he's in there, he's being treated. After visiting hours, the nurses were having problems with him. One of the nurses told his daughter after the event, said, well, see what happens after visiting hours. He gets up out of bed. He's supposed to be having rest, and he goes round from bed to bed, and he's preaching at people, and he's praying with them, and we tell him, you should be having a rest, Mr. Green said. I know. But then 5 minutes later, he's back out there, and he's wheeling his IV drip around the place as he does so. Why? Because he loves people, and because he's met this amazing person called Jesus. Second name for us now. I haven't got a picture of her. Judy Simpson. Who remembers Judy? Some of us do. Judy was part of the church here until, about 15 years ago, something like that. Judy had a very late diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. She was taken into hospital, as I recall it. I think she never made it home from hospital. She was within she died within 3 to 4 weeks of being diagnosed. The story's coming out from hospital. Okay, Judy didn't have any first-class honours degree. She's not famous, okay? Hasn't influenced millions of people in the way Michael Green has. Judy was getting out of bed, and, you know, she was in pretty desperate state, going around talking to people and praying for them, knowing that she had terminal cancer. I think there's something real and authentic about that. It's third one. I have got a photo here. Now, the photo isn't of Mike Hardway's grandparents. That photo is of Mike and Kirsten on their wedding day. They got married in 2010, I think it was. Went to the wedding, and it was a great day for me because I spilled a cup of tea down a white shirt, and it was fantastic. But during the wedding service, they made their vows. I declared you man and wife, etc., etc., etc. And they said, well, we're going to pray for them now. And this elderly couple got up, and they must have been mid-70s at least, I'd have thought. And they just stood there, and they just prayed for them. And I just watched them. I thought, this is amazing. Oh, could Ruth and I be something like that? It really impacted me. So I spoke to Mike afterwards and said, those people said, oh, yeah, I think they were his maternal grandparents. And he told me a little bit about their lives. Oh, yeah, they've been an amazing impact on a number of generations of people. Just go up and talk to them and things and said, ah. And what I saw there, simply through the act of these two people praying for a young couple, was something real and authentic. Final example now, another Green. This is just coincidence. Keith Green. Keith was a Californian, came to faith in his early 20s. He was killed in an aircraft crash in the early 80s, I think it was. He was 31, something like that, when he died. He'd been a Christian for 8 or 10 years. He had quite an impact on his generation. He came up with a few pithy phrases. That's one of my favourite there. It says, Jesus rose from the grave, and you can't even get out of bed. That might need to stick like a worm with some of us. Amazing bloke. By the time he was late 20s, he'd been a follower of Jesus for about 7 or 8 years, I think it was then. Getting a bit concerned about himself as to whether he was getting too cozy, too comfortable, and whether he was missing the point, and that he wasn't really as devoted and available to God as he should be. By that time, you know, he'd done a massive ministry. He and his wife had written songs, very influential. They had taken over 7 neighbouring houses so they could house the homeless. And that guy was wondering, where do I stand on things? I think history tells us that he was a real and authentic follower of Jesus. So we're going to listen to one of his songs now. This is a song that he wrote late one night. He's got a little bit of preamble at the beginning. And I want us to use this just to help us to think about what being real and authentic as a follower of Jesus really looks like. Okay? I want you to protect yourself from one thing, okay? Which if something gets into your head and gets in the way, oh, that's fine for them, it's not for me, okay? That's a lie from the pit of hell, okay? If you say, well, you can never do that, or you're useless or rubbish, that equally is a lie from the pit of hell. Because this is part of Jesus praying for you. His words apply to you and to me today. That you and I should be one, that we should be in the Father and in him, that we have come to know something of his glory and we can be bearers of his glory as we authentically reflect his Father, okay? So don't let this be heavy. Put yourself in the place of, is it time for you perhaps to stand alongside Keith Green as he considers writing this song? Let's see where this takes us to. The calling we have received, if we have responded to the call of Jesus, it's a high and it's a holy calling. And that's nothing to do with whether you're called to be a pastor or a missionary. If you're called to be a follower of Jesus, you've heard his voice, and with whatever degree of faltering there is in your voice, you said yes. That is a high and a holy calling. He has prayed for you and for me that we might be one, that we might be in the Father and in the Son, and that we might be true bearers and reflectors of his glory, of the splendor of his character. It's easy to tick off 11 points on a list. But being real and authentic means that we're a source of life for others. And that's what Jesus wants of his people. More and more, you and I are being transformed into the likeness of Jesus, so that we increasingly walk like him, we increasingly talk like him, and we increasingly live like him. We're going to come to communion now. You don't have to feel hopeless at all about this, because Keith Green started off in absolutely the right place for what he confessed. Lord, you're beautiful. Your face is all I seek. Let's do that now as we come to communion.